This is an ABC podcast.
They've got great work ethics. They want to work, minimal amount of headache. You tell them to do a job once, they'll do it. You won't get an Australian worker doing some hard yakka. That's gone in the past. There's no one that wants to work within Australia in the farming sector.
For the second year in a row, Pacific Island workers have saved the crops of blueberry growers on the Coffs Coast as labour shortages continue to challenge farmers. And as the Labor Party looks to introduce a bill to scrap the controversial cashless debit card, debate over the program intensifies.
When we first heard about it, it was like bringing back memories about the station days where people were getting ration and things, you know? Welfare system from the past. That's what it brought back memories about those times.
I'm Alex Hyman and this is Australia Wide. Firstly tonight, the COVID-19 vaccine rollout in WA has been slow among Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Less than a quarter of Indigenous people over the age of 12 in WA have been fully vaccinated, well below the national average. But one community in the Kimberley has bucked the trend with 90% of its residents fully vaccinated. Now locals are turning their attention to reopening to visitors. Jackie Lynch has this report from Beagle Bay.
Usually, the remote Indigenous town of Beagle Bay is bustling with tourists, but for the last 18 months, it's been quiet. Closed to outsiders due to the state government's COVID-19 travel restrictions on remote communities. Now there's a light at the end of the tunnel for Beagle Bay.
We're actually on the mark of 90% of getting vaccinated.
That's Karina Sebastian, and she couldn't be prouder to be the Beagle Bay chairperson.
It's been really, really, really good. So I'm really happy for our community of Beagle Bay getting vaccinated and looking after our mob.
She says the community is on track to have everyone vaccinated by Christmas.
I guess one little Christmas present from Father Christmas to give us community a vaccination, and hopefully our word voice can be heard out there for the other rest of the communities, I guess throughout the whole of Australia.
It's been a big job, but Ms. Sebastian says local health authorities, community leaders and elders have helped get the message out to people on the ground to get vaccinated.
They're actually doing a really good job as the clinic staff within our community, verbally going out and face-to-face to see families and members of our community to see if they've been vaccinated or if they need to get vaccinated. So we're really, really improving, and I'm really proud of our people, of Beagle Bay community.
Now that vaccination rates are so high, community leaders are turning their attention to reopening and welcoming back tourists travelling up the Dampier Peninsula.
This place was pretty lively once upon a time. You know, we used to have about nearly 45 to 50 tourist cars coming in a day, you know, and, you know, it's because of our icon that we have here, our church. With that, hopefully by next year we can get our community open, hopefully about January, February somewhere.
The plan has been backed by former Beagle Bay chairperson Arnold Sahana, who was the first to get the jab at the local clinic back in March.
I think Beagle Bay was the first to get the needle. I really think Beagle Bay should be the first to reopen.
Mr. Sahana was also one of the first Indigenous people to get the jab at a remote clinic in WA. He played a big role in encouraging others to have the vaccine.
When they seen me have my vaccine and I didn't have any after effects, I think that's what encouraged them all to have it.
And he says the community has come a long way.
I'd say 50% was all for it. The other 50 was a bit doubting, you know, doubting about it. Community power, working together, you can get things done quicker.
In other parts of WA, it's a different story. According to the National Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation, less than a quarter of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people over 12 in WA are fully vaccinated. Medical Director Jason Agostino says he's really worried about how the rollout is going.
Unfortunately, Beagle Bay is an outlier, and the vaccination rates for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people across WA are the lowest in the country.
Dr. Agostino says the impact COVID-19 has had on Indigenous people in New South Wales and Victoria has been devastating.
So far, there have been over 5,000 cases amongst Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people just in the last 2 months. 600 people have been hospitalised, over 60 have been in ICU, and 11 people have died. And that's happened really quickly. And so, you know, any myths that this doesn't impact Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are definitely blown completely out of the water now.
He's hoping the successful vaccine take-up in Beagle Bay will help inspire other communities.
A great thing for Beagle Bay. They've protected their communities. And we know that to really protect communities across Australia, we need to be looking at all communities getting at least 90%.
And Karina Sebastian couldn't agree more.
Get your mob vaccinated, get your community vaccinated, get your family vaccinated.
That's Beagle Bay Chairperson Karina Sebastian ending that report by Jackie Lynch.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
Indeed, right now you are listening to Australia Wide with me, Alex Hyman. Great to have your company. Workers from the Pacific Islands have brought much-needed relief to blueberry growers on the Coffs Coast, saving their crops from going to waste 2 years in a row. Normally, berry farmers rely on backpackers to pick their fruit, but COVID-19 has made that close to impossible. As a result, the region's largest berry cooperative, Oz Group Co-op, which represents more than 150 berry farmers, has brought in more than 200 workers from Vanuatu and the Solomon Islands to help with this year's harvest. Rural reporter Killy Johnson met with Oz Group's acting CEO, Stephen Thandy.
This is the first year of picking. The first couple of picks are slow, but now they're really up to speed as with the regular contractors.
So it hasn't taken long?
No, it hasn't taken long. No, they're really good. They've got good work ethics.
Now, tell me, what happened last year when COVID was about but there wasn't this scheme in place?
Towards the end of the year, we lost literally hundreds of thousands of dollars of fruit. A lot of the contractors that were in Australia, they left to go back into the grape seasons and other parts of Australia, and we were left hanging here.
And it's not just you. You've been speaking to other your neighbours, other farmers. Did they also lose a lot of crop last year?
They certainly did, and we did put it out to all of our group growers to be part of this scheme. At first, they all jumped on it, then they got hesitant. It was left to us 18 or 19 at the end that stayed on the scheme. We did actually have, supposed to have 300 people come in, but only 211 available.
Do you know why that was?
It's the quarantine costs. It's the flights weren't coming in, so we've been told. Then they're going to source them from within Australia. Now they've been used up elsewhere, so we're down 90 odd people.
And how helpful has the Pacific Island workers been?
Oh, they've been great. You know, they've got great work ethics. They want to work. Minimal amount of headache. You tell them to do a job once, I'll do it.
Stephen says the industry has relied on these workers from overseas, as Australians just aren't jumping at farm labour work.
You won't get an Australian worker doing some hard yakka. That's gone in the past. Oz Group itself is part of the BCCM, which is the Business Council of Cooperatives and Mutuals, and I've had contact with other chairs from around Australia, and they're all in the same situations. There's no one that wants to work from within Australia in the farming sector.
Daniel Jim James used to work as a delivery driver in Vanuatu, but when the COVID-19 pandemic hit, he and many others lost work. He says when a Facebook post popped up on his feed advertising the opportunity to work on a farm in Australia, he applied right away.
We arrived about 2 months. We don't probably have much work, but after 2 months, we start busy. Yeah.
And why have you come to work in Australia?
The only opportunity that helps me a lot with my family. I grew up without that, so I used to help my mom and my other three brothers. So coming here is very good, helped me a lot. So now I have family, they depend on me, yeah.
Do you send money back home to Vanuatu?
Yeah, I already sent 4 times, yeah. Most of us lost job. Because we have a small economic, yeah, and people lost job, so opportunity to come here is very good to everyone.
Similar to Daniel, Natalie Harrow has come to work in Australia to support her family back in the Solomon Islands, most of which have also lost work.
My sister got laid off from work. Yeah, it's kind of hard to get a job back in my country.
And how have you found coming to Australia? Has it been all right?
Yeah. Gives me the privilege to help my family back at home with the money I earn here. I send them some money and I get by fine with my earnings here. We don't get this kind of money week in here. We don't get that back at home in a week.
That was Natalie Hero, who is currently working on a blueberry farm on the Coffs Coast to support her family back in the Solomon Islands. And that story was by Keely Johnson.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
In federal parliament yesterday, Labor MP Julian Hill introduced a bill which he says would stop the government from putting pensioners on its cashless welfare card and ultimately scrap the controversial system. Social Services Minister Anne Rustin says that's unnecessary and he's fear-mongering among older Australians. But beneath the politics, how is the card impacting people on the ground? Goldfields reporter Sean Tariq Goodwin has this story.
Deputy Speaker, pensioners have a right to control how they spend their own money, so I'm proud to introduce this bill.
That's Labor MP Julian Hill in federal parliament yesterday. He's talking about his private member's bill to limit the government's controversial cashless welfare card. The card quarantines up to 80% of a recipient's government benefit, which can't be converted to cash and can only be spent at approved places.
It implements Labor's policy to scrap the government's cruel scheme, liberating thousands of Australians, including disability pensioners, carers and others already on this card, and protecting all pensioners from being forced onto this card.
But the Social Services Minister, Anne Rustin, says the bill is unnecessary and aimed at fear-mongering older Australians.
The federal government never has and never will force aged pensioners onto the cashless debit card, whether they be in trial sites or sites that currently have the card or anywhere else in Australia. We never have and we never will.
But Julian Hill and the Labor Party don't just want to limit the card. They want to phase it out altogether.
The evidence is now clear. The card's been trialled for some years and the Senate committee inquiries and indeed the Auditor General of the Commonwealth, the independent Auditor General, has said that the evidence behind the government's claims do not stack up, that the card does more harm than good.
But the Social Services Minister says a study by the University of Adelaide found the card is reducing dysfunctional behaviour.
That evidence was things like 25% of people reported that they were drinking less, 21% of people reported that they were gambling less, and 45% of cashless debit card participants actually indicated that they believed that it improved things for themselves and their family.
Social work and policy expert Ruth Phillips says there's more to those numbers than what meets the eye.
It's very easy to produce data of, say, a 30% reduction in alcohol consumption or something in a particular area, but very hard to prove that that is actually a real statistic when it comes down to what people are doing. And there's all sorts of stories about people trading their card for alcohol and finding ways around those restrictions.
Professor Phillips says the system makes life harder for vulnerable people.
People who are fleeing, say, domestic violence and they find the right place but the landlord wants payment in cash, you can't do that. So everywhere you turn, you're being controlled and limited in choice of what you do with your income.
Look at all the majority of local people here, all my family actually, so they've all been on the card.
That's senior Mirrawung man David Newry in WA's East Kimberley region, which is one of the sites where the card is operational.
When we first heard about it, it was like bringing back memories about the station days where people were getting ration and things, you know, welfare system from the past. That's what it brought back memories about those times.
He says its impacts have been mixed.
Kids couldn't afford to get any money off families, as they usually does, then they started looking elsewhere, and that's when a lot of the theft started happening around kind of a small family group that have little children. They were saying it was really good for them to receive that payment through the card.
He said the main issue has been a lack of meaningful engagement with people subject to the card.
You know, you have to live with Aboriginal people to understand them. If people were consulted about the whole card thing, then they would have, you know, stayed their case, whether they would like it or not. But it was something that was initiated by other people, you know, and people were forced to, well, under the welfare system, they just didn't have chance but to receive it.
Minister Anne Rustin says the card isn't going anywhere, but the government is open to adjusting the system.
As I said, the most important thing for us to do and what we continue to do is engaging with your communities and other communities where this card is in operation, to make sure that we are working to make it the most beneficial tool to people in the community.
Goldfields reporter Sean Tariq Goodwin there.
ABC Australia Wide.
Just because there's no smoke in Sydney doesn't mean the people down here still don't need help.
On ABC Radio.
South Australian lobster fishers and exporters are exploring different markets as China's trade ban continues. But many say they're still really struggling after losing access to the lucrative market. Some fishermen are even now going to the lengths of setting up food trucks in a bid to find local markets for their catch. Megan Hughes has this story.
Port Macdonald fisher Nick Richards is working around the clock, and he's not even on his cray boat. He's kitting out a food truck where he can sell the rock lobsters he catches straight to the public.
Pretty much just bit the bullet and said, well, we've only got little quota, we've only got a little licence, so I'm going to try and maximise what I've got to support me and my family. So I just thought, well, I've got everything, I'll just put it all together and have a go.
So tell me about how the schedule works, because obviously you have to catch the crays. This is, you know, you have a cray boat, you've got to go out there, and then now you've got to sell them.
So at the moment, schedule is as soon as your eyes are open, get to work, get the family involved, and just try and get on the road and sell a fish. But I will be hoping, so we're a lot to do with the weather too, it's weather permitting, I'll be able to hopefully fish Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, on the road Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Mr. Richards purchased a processing licence last year after China's trade ban came into effect. He's now going to be hitting the road around the southeastern Riverland selling freshly cooked rock lobster.
On mobile I can go, so I'll go that little bit further. Like I'm going to try for Keith, Narracourt and Berry. Come summertime, a little bit further down the line when I get rightfully up and running, if I can, I'll try and hit more of the Riverland because those guys just seem to have more money. Hi, hello Riverland. Years ago when I was like 13, 14, I went with a bloke and we went up to Broken Hill and sold like 600 or 700 kilo up there in about half a day. It just went mental, and ever since then I've just really wanted to do it. I've got the chance to do that, to get the craze up to where they normally don't get them.
Exporters are also exploring different markets. Andrew Ferguson is the managing director of a lobster processing company, Ferguson Australia. He says they're looking to other parts of Asia.
It depends on what size that you're selling. The larger sizes, there's still a bit of demand in the marketplace. A little bit of demand, I should say, but no, definitely the smaller ones are very hard to move at the moment. We're processing a lot of just about all the small ones into half lobsters for supermarkets, which is going, that seems to, you know, taking off. It's early days though, but it's looking like a good possibility for a new market opportunity there.
And for your larger one, where is that demand coming from?
A bit into Australia, into the local market in Australia, into Sydney and Melbourne, and overseas, Southeast Asia. Into those, you know, number of countries in through Southeast Asia, always look for larger lobsters, so that door is still open.
Any ones in particular?
Well, the usual ones, not really. You know, we send a little bit to Taiwan and Korea and down through and Malaysia. Basically, a lot of the Chinese communities in those countries sort of buy, like, to eat lobster too, southern rock lobster. But it's nowhere near, it's just a blip on the map as far as demand, as far as volume goes, taking the volume, as far as, you know, mainland China. But we have to keep searching for these niche markets.
Without China, rock lobster fishers can only access smaller markets, which quickly become oversupplied, which is why prices are so low. Victoria and Tasmania's seasons start next month, only adding to this pressure. Gordon Lewis runs two boats out of Port Macdonald. He's pulled them in and is hoping to wait it out.
Good prices, and then just crashed away. Now getting about $32 a kilo average.
And when you refer to like a good price, what would that be in comparison to $32?
The first few days was up around the $75, $80 mark.
Dropping more than half.
Yeah, dropping over half, yes. And not much in it at $32. It's costing us $30 or more to catch to catch the fish.
You have decided to pull your boats in and pull your pots in and just you're waiting it out?
Yeah, we'll just wait it out. But the season's only early. We're only just into it. But at this price, there's nothing in it. So we'll put them in the shed. We can go in there for 6 or 8 weeks. Maybe we'll get a bit of a spike just before Christmas. So we will be back in the water by then. And if the price hasn't picked up by then, we will still have to go and catch our fish at that price.
Are you hearing much from other fishermen in Port Mac who are doing similar things?
There's a lot of unease, as you can see. There's over half the boats home today because it's a perfect day, but they're home because there's no money to be made in it at this stage. So, well, a lot of boats are just fishing 1 or 2 days, trying to keep ticking over something and keeping an eye on their gear.
That's South Australian rock lobster fisher Gordon Lewis ending that report from Mount Gambier reporter Megan Hughes. And finally tonight, a rather, well, frightening story. Imagine a projectile smashing through your windscreen while travelling at close to 300 kilometres an hour. That's what happened to spray plane pilot Jim Robbins on Sunday when he collided with an ibis mid-flight. Rural reporter Angus Verley spoke with Jim about the hair-raising encounter.
I was out spraying some peas out near Quambatook and was just finishing a spray run and pulled up out of the paddock. And as I pulled up out of the paddock, I just looked out the window just to check the spray nozzles and whatnot, as I usually do, and just heard an almighty bang and thought, oh dear, what's that? And then I looked back forward again and realised that there was something hanging through the windscreen. I wasn't exactly sure what it was for a start, but yeah, just run through all the, you know, your initial checks to make sure that everything's okay and you're still flying and whatnot. And then, of course, it came through the windscreen and landed in my lap, and I realised at that point that it was an ibis. So I sort of grabbed it and threw it on the floor. And unfortunately, it was no longer with us. But, yeah, I just sort of slowed the plane down because I had quite a lot of glass coming in, flying on me and landing in my lap, and decided that I'd best fly back to my home base and, pull up for the day.
That's pretty terrifying stuff, Jim.
Yeah, I have hit birds before. I mean, we do a lot of rice work in the Riverina, and part of the hazard of spraying and spreading rice is a lot of ducks and different wildlife. So a lot of the time, you know, I generally try and make quite an effort to avoid them. But on this particular occasion, I didn't even see him coming. I don't think he saw me coming either.
And Jim, how'd you go actually seeing out of the windscreen? I imagine it was all fractured. Was it difficult to see where you were flying?
Well, there was a big hole in the windscreen, so I could see straight through it, fortunately. So, albeit pretty breezy, I could see quite clearly through it. So I was able to make a successful landing quite easily and pull up. So that wasn't a problem. There were bits of glass flying and whatnot, but I'm wearing a helmet and I had my visor down, so my eyes were perfectly protected, and it wasn't any real threat. Just it was a bit cold and windy. Obviously, when you're travelling at that speed, there's quite a lot of wind coming in through a hole in the windscreen.
And how fast were you travelling when you hit the ibis?
Oh, I was probably somewhere between 250 and 300 kilometres an hour, so I was fairly moving. Yeah, and obviously he was flying towards me, so I'd hate to think what the closing speed was. But it was a pretty big impact.
So at that speed, it's almost like having a missile hit you, I imagine.
Pretty much, yeah, they can be like just like a missile, really.
And how far back to home base was it?
It was probably about 35 kilometres, so, yeah, it took me 10 minutes to fly back, so it wasn't too bad. It could have been a lot worse. It's funny, I've had a lot of near misses with wedge-tail eagles, and they can be quite feisty, particularly if you're flying around where they're nesting. They'll often try and scare you and intimidate you and attack you to a certain degree. So I've always had a small fear of having a wedge-tail eagle in the cockpit with me, a very upset one at that. But I did have that initial thought that, oh, gee, I hope it's not a wedgie. Once it sort of landed in my lap, I worked out pretty quickly what it was.
That was a very composed Jim Robbins there from Robbins Aviation speaking with Angus Verley. And you can see a short video from Jim in the cockpit just after the bird strike and the hole in the windscreen. You can go to the ABC News website. And that is Australia-wide for this Tuesday night. I'll be with you again tomorrow. I'm Alex Hyman. Have a great evening. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.